My special guest today is Dr. Alex Tai, who is an infectious diseases registrar here at University Hospital in Geelong. Thanks, Alex, for your time.
No worries.
You've co-authored a short report for us on dengue fever and specifically whether or not we're missing
warning signs
in returning travellers. Tell me a little bit, if you can, about the different types of dengue fever and how we distinguish between them.
No worries. So dengue fever classically has been described as dengue fever and dengue hemorrhagic fever. So if you look at all the major papers and even in described literature, a lot of the times we think of dengue fever as having those two classifications. Now that's a lot of it stemmed from data coming out from Asian hospitals and big studies done in the 70s and the 80s. And what we've actually found increasingly over the decades leading up to sort of the late 90s is that that classification didn't quite catch a lot of the patients with severe dengue manifestations. So you may now hear of a revised classification done by the WHO, called the WHO 2009 classification, which classified dengue to dengue fever warning signs, as well as severe dengue. Now, how that came about was from a couple of things. What we were noticing more and more towards the later part of the 90s was that there were more and more people with dengue fever, with severe dengue fever, with severe manifestations like acute liver function tests being deranged, people that were really, really sick from acute hepatitis, from acute myocarditis, from acute renal failure, that weren't quite being caught in this classification of dengue hemorrhagic fever. Now, in order to actually have a diagnosis of dengue hemorrhagic fever, you had to have all four criteria of dengue hemorrhagic fever. So you need to have fever, you need to have bleeding tendencies, you needed to actually have thrombocytopenia, and as well as evidence of plasma leakage, so pleural effusions, ascites. A lot of patients that come in really sick from dengue fever didn't necessarily meet all those criteria. And so what happened in sort of the most recent times is there have been big studies in Latin America as well as in South Asia, looking at patients with severe manifestations that require intensive nursing care or ICU care. And what they've essentially done, these big studies have done, is they've actually looked at this patient population who needed this intensive care, intensive nursing care, as well as intensive sort of medical care, and gone, all right, what actually predicts getting these severe endpoints? And they've looked at these risk factors and they've come up with a new classification or proposed a new classification. So for example, in the new classification, in severe dengue, you only need to have one of three things. So those one of three things are patients with severe plasma leakage or shock, severe bleeding, or severe organ impairment. But they've also looked at this group of patients who needed intensive nursing care, and they've gone, all right, what are the factors that predict you getting to that stage? And that's where the warning signs came about. And so for the warning signs itself, I'm just running through a couple of things. So the warning signs, you had people with severe abdominal pain or tenderness. You need to have persistent vomiting, clinical fluid accumulation, so that's with pleural effusions, ascites, mucosal bleeding, severe lethargy, which is a bit of a iffy kind of warning sign because everyone who comes to dengue fever has severe lethargy, but severe profound lethargy, so really completely exhausted. Liver enlargement, so hepatomegaly greater than 2 centimeters, as well as a rapid drop in your platelet count with a concurrent rise in your hematocrit, 20%. So that's evidence of hemoconcentration.
Now, are these warning signs things that GPs can pick up, for example, in their clinic?
Yes, they can. So if you think about people who have abdominal pain. So if you suspect anybody with dengue fever with severe abdominal pain, persistent vomiting, anybody with an enlarged liver, with a platelet count that's really low for rising hematocrit, those are all potential warning signs that anybody can pick up at any stage.
Do they need more education about the warning signs? Is this classification system widely known to GPs?
So it's widely known throughout a lot of the countries where dengue fever is endemic, and the classification and the guidelines have been published online by the WHO. It's not as well managed, I guess, or well understood in Australia, because if you think of it, we don't have as many patients with dengue fever. A lot of our patients with dengue fever are return travellers. Even though our numbers are small, it's thought that the warning signs still are relevant in that setting. Because these are warning signs from an endemic setting that predict severe disease. The good thing about the new classification compared to the old dengue fever classification is that it's more user-friendly in a way, because it actually predicts severe endpoints rather than just basically predicting a syndrome, if that makes any sense. So if GPs at any stage find or detect any of those patients, you know, someone who you think has dengue fever coming back from Bali, which mm-hmm. which is a big proportion of a lot of our return travelers, who have any of these warning signs, I guess the trigger point for that consultation would be to get them to the hospital straight away. I guess where the warning signs come in to be relevant is basically the management of these patients, because at any different stage of dengue fever, the management changes slightly. So yep. Taking a step back right now, if you're thinking of dengue fever, I often like to tell, you know, some of the students I'm working with as well, people interacting with patients with potential dengue fever, the first part is, you know, suspecting, you know, who do you suspect has dengue fever? Now, that's pretty straightforward. Most clinicians have been trained, most medical students have been trained to actually think about dengue fever and return travelers in our context. So that's the first part. The second part, that even before you get into the warning signs, is which part of the dengue fever illness you suspect they're in. So for dengue fever itself, the spectrum of it ranges from different phases of dengue fever, if that makes any sense. So the yes. first phase of dengue fever would be the febrile phase. Anybody coming in with suspected dengue fever normally gets a fever for the first few days. So persistently high temperatures, 38, 39 degrees, persistently feeling unwell. They may have a fever, a rash, or the usual symptoms that you would suspect with dengue fever. That usually lasts for about 5 to 6 days. Occasionally they have a biphasic illness. So similar to our patient in the case report, he actually had a febrile illness for a good going 10 to 11 days. So it was a long period of time. So that's the febrile phase. And then the next phase is what we call the critical phase, where their fever suddenly drops. That's where their platelets plummet. That's where their white cell counts continues plummeting. That's where, if they were to actually get really sick with hemoconcentration, that's where the hematocrit will start rising. And then after that, the last phase is the convalescent phase, where they get better, the hematocrit goes back to normal, their white cell count, their platelet improves, and the patient basically gets better overall. Okay. The reason why that's actually important is it changes the management of dengue fever, changes every different phase of that. Now, dengue fever, I like to think of the management of dengue fever as fluid, fluid, and fluid. And we often think about dengue fever, especially in the Australian context, as, all right, it's just fever and a return traveler. There's no management, there's no antibiotics, there's no specific treatment, so let's just give them fluid or let's just see how they go. But we know that in an endemic setting, people who develop severe dengue fever die from dengue fever because they're not managed appropriately in terms of the fluids, and they die from refractory shock. I like to think of it as someone managing someone with DKA or diabetic ketoacidosis. If you don't manage the fluids that well, or you manage inappropriately, people die. Now, the reason why that's important is if I was seeing someone in the community in the febrile phase persistently unwell, of course, from a GP point of view, you get them to the hospital straight away. And from a hospital emergency point of view, that's a different, you know, I'll need to assess how much fluids I want to give a patient. And there are protocols in the WHO guidelines for every single phase a patient's in. If you're in the febrile phase, the management of the fluid, your fluid balance changes completely compared to being in the critical phase, which is then different again to the convalescent phase.
So tell us about the case report and what that prompted you to look into and what you found.
So it was a 38-year-old gentleman that came into a tertiary hospital I was working in at the time. And he was a migrant from Sri Lanka, so came back from a country with high risk for dengue fever. And in fact, actually looking back at the case, he actually was febrile for approximately 8 days in Sri Lanka. So it was persistently febrile and then devaversed just before he came across, hence giving him a false sense that he was actually getting better. And so he flew across for migration purposes. But then one day later, he started getting fever, return of fever again, and started getting diarrhea that prompted him to come to the hospital. And for a good going 4 days in the hospital, he was febrile. He started vomiting up blood, and his platelet count actually started dropping, and his white cell count as well started dropping. The one thing that really triggered this whole management and looking at the protocol was really the fact that we had a Sri Lankan doctor working with us at that time. And she had seen a lot of these patients from big dengue fever outbreaks in Sri Lanka. And so when she saw this patient straight away, she said, look, this patient has dengue fever, just purely from a clinical point, has dengue fever. And we need to manage him in terms of his fluids and everything based on this protocol. And of course, I wasn't at that stage that familiar with this. So we had to dig out the protocol. We ran through a couple of things. And we managed this guy with intense fluid monitoring because he was still in that febrile phase. So he actually had a biphasic illness, which is another, it has been associated with people with a more severe disease where you get a peak of your fever, you get better, and you get another peak again. So he had a biphasic peak of his fever, and he was managed quite intensively with TDS blood. So he had his bloods taken 3 times a day, he had his fluid balance looked at 3 times a day. We monitor his hematocrit, we monitor his platelet count, we're monitoring his input, output, managing all his fluids. And then approximately after 4 days in the hospital, he suddenly dropped his fever. And at that stage, I mean, if I didn't know the case that well, I would have thought, oh, great, he's getting better. But in fact, that's actually a sign of him going into the critical phase. And if you actually keep pushing enough fluids, you actually send these patients to overload, fluid overload. So there have been also case reports of people dying because of massive pleural effusions, acute pulmonary edema, because you just keep pushing the fluids, presuming that they're all right, they're dehydrated, whereas you actually need at that stage to draw back on the fluids. And so we just basically manage his input output. And there's a whole protocol in the WHO protocol also to actually manage that. So we pull back on his fluids, and approximately after 2 days, his platelet count started getting better, his white cell count started getting better.
Yeah.
And he came out with what we call a dengue convalescent rash. So an hour of red and a sea of white, where you get really itchy palms, itchy feet. And in a lot of sort of endemic countries, a lot of, you know, without the technology, I guess the monitoring that we have, that's the first sign of someone getting better. And so he suddenly got better from there.
So do Australian hospitals use these protocols as well as they should?
So we actually did a look at our management of our dengue fever cases after this case, you know, that we wrote up. And we looked at a couple of major metropolitan hospitals. We looked at three major tertiary hospitals in Victoria, as well as one tertiary hospital in Darwin.
Yep.
It's actually only one in Darwin. But
yeah.
And we actually looked back at approximately 200 cases of dengue fever, and we realized that not many people actually looked at these protocols for managing these people. And I suspect that has stemmed from this assumption that there's no treatment per se for dengue fever apart from fluid. And we haven't had that many severe cases of dengue fever to actually prompt that judicious look and monitoring of these patients. So as an example, we had only one in 208 cases with severe dengue on that look back that we actually did that we're currently writing up at the moment. And so the question that you may have to me is, all right, then if not many people get severe disease in our Australian population, is it still worthwhile following these protocols or managing these patients or even sending all these patients into the hospital for management? And the short answer is, because our patient population, our cohort, is small, if you think about 1 in 200 still comparative to actually if you had 200,000 people, 20,000 people in the big outbreaks you get in the big countries, that's still roughly the same proportion of people that get severe disease. We had 20,000 travelers coming back. We probably would have more cases of severe disease, and all it takes is that one patient to actually die for us to actually manage them, institute change. So I guess what we've been proposing is looking at instituting these protocols in more and more of our return travelers, with some slight differences, obviously. Now, a lot of the protocols in the WHO have been based on patients in the endemic setting, as opposed to our return travelers. What they've actually proposed in the WHO protocols is that some people with just dengue fever without warning signs, they can be managed in an outpatient setting. And it's only the patients with warning signs that need to actually be sent in the hospital. And of course, the patients with severe dengue get managed in an ICU setting. But what we have suspected, and actually what we're proposing, based on all the study, based on the data we looked at, is if somebody has suspected dengue fever and there's uncertainty of which stage they're in or how sick they are, just send them into the hospital. Because there's this whole idea of, do they have warning signs? Do they not have warning signs? I think it's good that people are looking out for the warning signs, but sometimes the warning signs actually develop over the next few days. So some option, the couple options we're proposing for GPs especially. So if you're not certain how to recognize these things, but you kind of know that somebody's sick and unwell with suspected dengue fever, send them into the hospital. And we can easily assess that, work it out, with your infectious diseases colleagues or with the ED staff. The other thing that some GPs could do, and certainly this has been the case in endemic countries, and this is exactly what the WHO protocol recommends, is if you have somebody who doesn't have warning signs in an outpatient setting, you can actually watch them. But you need to be watching out for these warning signs. So the 7 warning signs we spoke about just now, stuff like abdominal pain, intractable vomiting, hepatomegaly, those are signs that are easily detectable from a clinical setting or clinical examination in the GP setting.
Yeah.
So that's another option.
So you get them in the next day.
Correct. Obviously, that needs to be done, monitoring these patients on a very close basis. And a lot of patients who are managed in the endemic setting, they actually looked at in the outpatient clinic on a daily basis to watch for those warning signs, which is the reason why also we suggest to GPs, if you're not sure whether they have warning signs or you suspect that they may develop warning signs, just send them in the hospital, because from an Australian context, it's sometimes maybe really difficult managing these patients in that outpatient setting. From a hospital point of view, I guess that's so from a GP point of view, I would have a very low threshold of just sending them into the hospital for management. from a hospital point of view, from an ED staff point of view, we've also had a lot of patients being sent back home once, you know, hospitals, for example, looked at these patients and got, all right, they're otherwise well. We suspect they have dengue fever, the management is just fluid, but otherwise look all right, send them back home. It was mainly realizing, number one, that there is this whole protocol of managing dengue fever, similar to how there's a whole protocol of managing DKA, and realizing that managing dengue fever isn't as simple as just, let's just give them fluids, but it's recognizing which, you know, I guess in summary, it's recognizing which phase of dengue fever they're in, and then based on that, what sort of treatment you give them. And even then, it's a whole dynamic process.
Thank you for your time.
No worries.